danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 157 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Somerville, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from San Francisco, California, is Andrew Brokus. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. Happy New Year, by the way. I guess this is maybe our third show into the New Year, but I haven't said it to you, and we haven't said it to our listeners, so Happy New Year, everybody.
Yeah, Happy New Year, absolutely. This is, I guess this is our fourth calendar year of doing the show, right?
Sounds right. Well, it's our fourth, I think it's the
fourth calendar year in which we have done the show, yes.
Right. So, yeah, I guess we're coming up on 3.5 years now. We started in September.
Something like that.
Yeah.
It's been a wild ride.
So. Well, other than continuing to pump out podcasts consistently, do you do the whole New Year's resolution thing? Do you have any poker-related resolutions you want to share?
I actually don't have poker-related resolutions. I'm kind of comfortable with my pattern of doing poker things and studying. You know, I'm always going to want to be studying and getting better and doing things, but I'm comfortable with where I am. One might say complacent. I hope not. But, you know, I should keep on studying. I mean, there are a million things I'd like to do better as a poker player, but... yeah, with other things going on in my life, I'm happy with the rate at which I'm improving at poker. You know, there's a bit of sadness here because for a long time I just wanted to be as good as I could possibly be, and now I've just got some other stuff going on, and I can't really pour myself into poker improvement the way I once was able to. But I certainly want to keep improving at poker, and I will keep improving at poker. Just, I think, not in the way that requires resolutions. What about you?
Yeah, I definitely don't have real firm resolutions, which I have done in the past. I mean, if you look back over the history of the blog, there's, you know, I've done a couple of when I was playing poker, when poker was a more robust part of my income stream. It is still kind of my primary source of income, but in terms of where I spend my time now, I mean, between the podcast and the videos and the coaching and everything else, like poker is it's not as big a part of the portfolio as it used to be. But there were a few years when I did have pretty firm, similar to what we talked about with TJ last week, which for those of you interested in this subject, I think listening to episode 156, the last episode with TJ Yurkevich, I think, and reading his thread on 2+2, and you can see over the course of like 2 years how he sets these goals for himself week to week, month to month, year to year, and obviously that was very effective for him personally in terms of motivating himself. So if you really want to see, I would say a pretty good example of someone using those and also learning over time how to use them a little bit more effectively, I think that's a very good place to look. And I'd encourage people to check out that interview and that 2+2 thread if they haven't already. That was episode 156, the one before this one. I've done some stuff like that in the past, but I think similar to you, I'm maybe even a little more comfortable using the word complacent, but yeah, I just feel like right now, there are a couple times a year when I know I'm going to be playing a lot of poker. You know, if I'm preparing to go abroad to play online, or I'm preparing to go to Las Vegas for the World Series or something like that, in the month leading up, I'll just try to do a lot more studying and you know, kind of intensive study at that point. But right now I just sort of study whatever comes up, you know, whatever hands I happen to play in a given session. I might think through one or two of them, or hands that people send into the podcast, stuff that students come up with. It's a little more haphazard, like what kind of stuff I'm studying right now.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you make a good point. I don't quite have as much going on poker-wise as you do with the coaching and everything, but I do, largely thanks to this show, you know, I read emails, you know, really smart people write in with hands and they have thoughts, and like just in the course of, you know, writing for Poker News and doing the show, and I do a little bit of coaching, etc., like, you know, poker strategy really is a constant part of my life, and I've always got stuff sort of coming across my desk, and just doing that sort of naturally gives me poker study time.
The one thing that I don't have like a real firm goal related to this, but I do want to be a little bit more aggressive about trying to find new and interesting guests for the show. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that over time, but you know, we're continuously reducing the amount of low-hanging fruit that's out there. And so I'm starting to do a little bit more cold contacting people. And you know, if you're a listener and there's people you're interested in hearing on the show, especially if you have some connection to that person, a way of getting their attention, then please do let us know. We've had a lot of luck with user-suggested guests. And I think in some cases when we are trying to get someone who is who you could consider like a big get, if I'm just cold contacting them on Twitter, if a bunch of people are like liking that tweet or responding to it and saying like, oh yeah, I'd really like this to happen, I'm sure that helps our credibility. Like, I don't necessarily expect that all of the biggest names in poker are going to be familiar with this show. So if you ever see me, you know, because Twitter is my main means of doing this, if you ever see me, you know, just cold contacting somebody on Twitter and saying something like, you know, hey, my name's Andrew Brokus, I host this podcast, would you be interested in coming on? If that's a person that you would like to see as a guest, please do favorite that tweet and you know, maybe respond to it and say, oh yeah, that would be awesome, you know, this is a good show. Just anything that can increase our credibility in that person's eyes. Sorry, let me go answer the door real quick.
Yeah. So while we've got a little bit of dead air, Jan Heitman, if you are listening to this show, we played together in the 2013 main event, and I invited you to come on the show, and then I lost your email address, and I've had a hard time, you know, sort of tracking you down since then. So if you are Jan Heitman, or if you know Jan Heitman, you know, let's make that happen, because you seem like a cool cat, and I would like to know more about poker in Germany. So that's my plug while Andrew's answering the door. You back, Andrew?
What a bummer. It wasn't even for me.
Oh, that's rough. That's rough. I filled in
someone else's package.
Yeah, I filled in some of this with but not all of it. Left us with some dead air. I was begging Jan Heitman to come on the show in case he's listening. Which is unlikely, but you never know.
Yeah, no, I was thinking that we should try to get in touch with him. This seemed like a good time to do it.
Yeah. Man, he was a cool cat. Like, not yeah. So he's on TV. He knows about poker in Germany. It's amazing.
If you enjoy the strategy segments on this show, then you'll love Tournament Poker Edge. Tournament Poker Edge has a library of hundreds of videos from not just myself, but lots of great players playing at a variety of stakes. It's a great way to take your game to the next level, and you can take your first step today by signing up at tournamentpokeredge.com. This hand is coming to us from a 1-3 no-limit hold'em game at the Horseshoe in Baltimore, and it was played by Jake. Jake says, I think this is an example of how my reads and assumptions were completely wrong. So, villain one on Jake's immediate left is known to me. He's a middle-aged guy who's very passive and rarely a winner in the game. He likes to complain about how he always loses with ace-king and hates raising with big hands because they never hit. He's already gotten drawn out on with a couple good hands and is frustrated and a little card dead. I think we all know that type.
Yeah, it's always funny when these things that are so cliched that it's not even funny to joke about anymore, then you hear them at poker tables unironically. Like, yeah. You know, yeah, okay.
Villain two is the main villain in the hand. He's a gentleman in his late 70s, tight pre-flop, and a little weak post-flop unless he has the goods. We hadn't played any pots together, but I'd seen him show down a couple good hands, and he was winning for the session. He'd picked my interest an hour earlier when he called a big check raise on the turn and put in a two-thirds pot bet with King-9 on a King-9-8, Queen-3 board, ended up getting called by King-10. It may have been bad, but I started to view him with some suspicion. I don't know that I would consider that bad, but I would consider it. I think you'll see a lot of players of this type not make that value bet on the river, even though it probably is a good bet.
Yeah.
So I think it is noteworthy, although I wouldn't necessarily say that. I mean, obviously, it depends on the action and whatnot. But I do think it's noteworthy as a possible exception to this read that he's very passive without the goods, because this was a hand where he made a at least moderately thin value bet that some very passive players would not make. Jake continues, my image was reasonably tight pre-flop and aggressive post-flop. I'd shown down a few hands that weren't strong. Villain 1 was playing $300, Villain 2 had approximately $500, and I had them both covered. This again is a 1-3 no-limit game. I was in middle position, and after under the gun limped, I raised to $16 with King Jack of Spades. Villain 1, the middle-aged guy, called. Villain 2 called on the button. Everybody else folded. I wasn't thrilled about King Jack against either of their calling ranges, especially Villain 1. This all seems pretty reasonable to me so far. I think King Jack suited opening, you know, against a limper. Yeah, I think it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I think it's all straightforward. I also think it's great that he's like actively thinking about how his hand matches up against their ranges as the hand is going on. So this is all very good.
Mm-hmm. And I would encourage, you know, maybe just put a little more substance behind that. When you say you're not thrilled about it against their calling ranges, you know, there's a few things we can probably rule out. I would expect that hands like, you know, aces and kings and maybe queens are three betting a lot of the time pre-flop, so I wouldn't expect to be dominated very often by bigger pairs. I think what he might be getting at is that they probably aren't calling with a lot of hands that he dominates. In other words, there's probably not a lot of king 10, king 9, you know, jack 10 in their calling ranges, which is largely true. I would think, though, that some, like your queen jack suited, jack 10 suited, those probably are hands that these players are calling with. I think that these players still, I mean, they're still there to play poker, and they kind of enjoy playing those hands that have like a decent chance of turning into strong hands after the flop because they can make straight and flush draws and whatnot. So I think it's good to be cautious, but you don't want to overestimate it either. I mean, you don't want to say, this is a tight player, I must be dominated. I can imagine reasons why some of the hands that dominate you would be re-raising pre-flop, and also reasons why some hands that you dominate would be calling pre-flop. So I think it's a good thing to be conscious of, but I don't, you know, I think it's easy to read too much of this and to say like, uh-oh, tight players, and I have, you know, King Jack, I'm probably dominated.
I agree.
Jake did recognize that the Jack 3-3 rainbow flop, which did not have any spades, so no backdoor draw for our hero. The Jack 3-3 rainbow is a pretty good flop for him, obviously. He says, I wanted to get some value from pocket pairs, any worse jacks, and maybe overcards, which would peel once. So I let out for $20 into a $51 pot after rake. I think betting here is a good idea. I mean, the hero is likely to have the best hand. As he says, there are second best hands that are out there. I like the sizing here as well. I like that he's going a little smaller than half pot. I think because this is a board that, you know, for one thing, he as the preflop raiser has a pretty strong range advantage on this board. You know, whichever player had the strongest hand preflop probably still has the strongest hand on this particular flop. It's not a flop that improves a lot of hands. So I think that, you know, it's a board that's conducive to using smaller sizing. I can imagine reasons why Hero might want to bet even weaker hands than this, because, you know, a hand like pocket 10s or pocket 9s, for a small enough bet, can still be a value bet and definitely gains a lot from protection as well. So I think this is a very good spot to use smaller than half pot sizing, and I think a lot of people just tend to default to betting, you know, somewhere between half and three quarters pot. So I want to kind of applaud the hero, even if he didn't, you know, think it through in exactly the way that I am now. I think at least his instincts were right in terms of sizing here.
I agree.
So he bets $20. Villain 1 calls, and then Villain 2, who is that tight older player, raises to $50. So the action is back on the hero with now $140 in the pot and 30 more for Jake to call. Jake says, alarm bells start going off immediately as I'm now playing a big pot against two opponents out of position. I thought this player's range was mostly 10s through queens, jack 10 through ace jack, and maybe 8s or 9s. I couldn't see him calling preflop with any 3 except exactly pocket 3s. Based on his image and my stereotyping, I thought he was almost never bluffing in this spot. That all sounds right to me, and I think I'm, you know, like him, I'm worried, but probably not folding, getting almost 5-1.
Yeah, I'm not advocating for a fold. I do think that hands like Jack 10 are very likely to just call. Like, it could be a see where I'm at raise, but also people just see where they're at by calling, and people are more inclined to raise on non-dry boards, I think. So I might be a little more worried than Jake is here. On the other hand, it's $30 into a lot of dollars, so I'm not sure I can really fold.
Yeah, that's the main point, is it's one thing to be worried, but you don't want to go too overboard with that either. You know, I do think we're beat here more often than not. I just don't think we're beat here, you know, often enough that I'm going to fold this, getting the kind of odds that I'm getting.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I can think of a lot of players who I'd fold against, but, you know, with only this kind of a read, I would call.
Jake did call, and Villain One, the player in between, called as well. With the pot around $200, the turn brings a six. Jake says, I didn't see any reason to bet, and I agree with that. So I checked, Villain One checked, Villain Two tanked for about 45 seconds and then bet $90. So now we're facing a bet of 90 into 200 with a third player yet to act behind us. I think I'm inclined towards folding here, yeah?
Easy fold, I think.
Yeah.
Described. It's hard to catch up if you're behind, and you're behind almost always, and yeah. I would, especially with the sizing, it's easy to say this is a 45% of the pot bet, but I think the absolute size of the bet is significant here also. I think calling would be very poor here. I think it's a good fold.
Yeah, I mean, our reasoning for calling on the flop was based on a couple of things. I mean, one was pot odds, which we're not getting nearly as good odds now as we were on the flop. Two is we were hoping there was some chance the villain might be raising for some combination of, like, protection and you know, seeing where he's at or something, which he kind of got his answer on the flop when two people called him. Like, if he had pocket nines and he was thinking there was a chance he was good on the flop, he probably is not thinking there's a chance he's good anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, if he's betting with nines now, he's kind of like turning it into a bluff. And Jake has already said this player didn't seem real likely to bluff. And I think it's a pretty bad spot for him to try to, you know, push through a bluff with a hand like pocket nines. So just a lot of the things that made this a call on the flop are no longer there now.
Yeah. And there are, like, better hands to call down with if we want to do some bluff catching. Hands that don't have a jack in them, for example.
I mean, I think, like, queens is a much better hand than ace jack here.
Yeah. I mean, also, I think
king jack.
Yeah, I think kings and aces are also hands we could play this way that are significantly better to call with. So, good fold.
Yep. Jake says, I folded quickly only to see villain one call again. The turn was a brick deuce. Villain one check called a river shove from villain two for his last $130 or so. Seeing how the turn and river played out, I was thrilled with my fold. I mean, I think you're kind of getting, I guess it's similar to what we were talking about last week with overinterpreting too much from seeing the results on Bovada. You know, I think you make the right fold. You don't want to be too biased by what ends up happening afterwards, but the fact that this will often happen afterwards. It's confirming that you made the right fold, I guess. I'm always nervous about people reading too much into results, but I mean, the fact that this will happen often is the reason why we're folding on the turn. And the results are that villain one, this is the player who made the first call and then subsequently just did a bunch of calling after the flop, had pocket aces. So I was a little off in my assumption about thinking that those were going to get through that all the time. Villain two, this is the one who raised on the flop, had pocket sixes. So he raised the flop with pocket sixes on the jack 3-3 and then drilled his full house on the turn and got paid for it. And Jake says, I was flabbergasted, having never thought he was the type to raise two opponents on a relatively dry board with a middle pocket pair. Obviously, the turn was a great catch for him, but I think he was sticking a big bet in on most turns. This is just a good reason why you don't want to ignore pot odds entirely when I mean, I think that Jake had more or less the right read that you're not real likely to be ahead here on the flop, even though, I mean, and as it turned out, you weren't ahead of villain one, which is a real consideration. Like, it's not just a matter of what does villain two have, even though he ought to have the stronger range of the two. But there is a real chance that you're beat by villain one as well when you're facing that little flop raise. But at the same time, you know, you have to consider, like, just how often is that going to happen? And sometimes your reads are off. Sometimes people just do weird things because they're bored or, you know, who knows what else, frustrated about something. People just do weird things sometimes. So I think, you know, not deviating too much from, you know, the optimal strategy based on a kind of weak read is a good idea. And this is all a good example of why, you know, like the fact that it turned out villain two actually did have a hand that you were way ahead of. And it's part of the reason why you don't want to fold when you're getting 5-1. And then as you get increasingly more information and less good odds, then you can be more comfortable laying your hand down. So yeah, I think the results here do corroborate a lot about, you know, why Hero should be playing this hand the way that he did.
I agree. I'm a little more skeptical than Jake is that a big bet was coming on most turns. I think a lot of people, as described, are just raising for whatever reason on the flop, but then when they get called in two places, we'll shut down. But I think
I agree with that.
Yeah, so that's the only part that I'm, I think that's my biggest point of disagreement with Jake here. But other than that, I think he does a great job going through the hand.
So nice job, Jake. Interesting hand, and I think very, very well played and well thought out by you. And I think you're drawing the right lesson from it as well. If your lesson was, I guess, what Jake said at the beginning, an example of how my reads and assumptions were completely wrong. You do have to allow for the chance that those reads are wrong because they are assumptions. They're not facts or guarantees, and so you do have to take pot odds into consideration as well, and sort of think about just how far am I looking at deviating from the sort of optimal play or what I would do without a read, and how significantly am I deviating from that based on this read that I think I have, and do I really have enough confidence in that read to make such a significant deviation? I think that's a real important skill to have, and well exhibited by Jake here.
Yep.
All right, thanks for writing in, Jake, and others of you who are interested in hearing your hand discussed on the podcast@thinkingpoker.net. Right. The introduction that I'll give you is maybe about all that I know about you, honestly, which is a poker player, coach, pro for, I'm sorry, I forgot which of the New Jersey sites it is that you're representing.
Borgata Poker.
For Borgata Poker, instructor at Card Runners. And we'll get into, it's certainly underselling you to just say poker player and coach, but we'll get into the details of exactly what you've accomplished in those regards, because I think both your own accomplishments and in particular, actually your students' accomplishments are pretty impressive.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that
we've run a little well. But
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, they've. I think maybe my students have run a little well, but we'll get into that.
And I want to make sure we give a shout out to Carl Meller as well, who was the person who suggested this interview. So if it goes well, it's because we did a good job with the interview, and if it goes poorly, it's because Carl made a bad suggestion. So, Michael, I know you mentioned in the email that you sent to me that you started off in education before you got into poker.
Yeah, I graduated from school actually with a degree in geology. I went to Rutgers here in New Jersey, and geology was...
Two Rutgers guests in a row for us.
Oh, is that right? Who's the last one?
TJ Yurkevich.
Oh, okay, cool. There's a few other New Jersey poker players that I've now am friendly with that also went to Rutgers right when I was there that I didn't know that happened to be in some of the same lecture classes that I was in. But that's an aside. Anyway, I did graduate from... Rutgers with a degree in geology, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. My mom is a teacher, and she's always been kind of pushing me that direction. And I wound up becoming a staff assistant at an elementary school, just kind of because I can't teach with a geology degree. I would need to go back to school. So I was kind of feeling that out if that was what I really wanted to do.
And what does a staff assistant do?
Basically, you're in the class with the teacher, helping the teacher. I worked in the autistic program. So I worked with kindergartners through second graders, children with autism, and we were basically just kind of, a lot of times people think of the staff assistants as like the people in the lunchroom, like helping the kids, clean their trays and like just making sure they're not, killing each other or anything like that. But we were more actually like we worked one-on-one with these kids, and it was a really great experience, honestly. I'm really happy that I had the chance to do that because I've referenced it so many times in different settings, whether it be just discussing education, discussing, special children with like autism and other special needs, or just children in general, because I got to work with all these, just kindergartners, first graders, and second graders for a couple of years. So that was really cool. But yeah, that was where I was going before poker kind of took over. I wasn't super happy at the school. I wasn't really making a lot of money, and the politics of, schools is just not something that super interests me. And it was getting a little overwhelming for me, where I didn't want to deal with that, and I was making good money on the side from playing poker, and it got to the point where I realized I was making a lot more from playing poker. So I was like, well, let me just leave the school. I'm gonna go to the World Series. This is 2009, I guess. I was like, I'm gonna go to the World Series, and then after the summer I'll start looking for another job or go back to school and start teaching. And that was what I told my mom, because she was very worried about me not having a job. And that just sort of never happened. That was just like, oh, I'll look next month. I'll look next month. And now we're in 2016, and I never looked for a job.
50-some months in still.
Yeah, so we'll see. Maybe next month I'll look for a job. But.
You know, it's funny. I've talked to so many teachers. I've worked in the past in a couple of public school districts, and you know, even people who I know you had your own set of challenges working with autistic kids, and obviously working in like in public schools, there's a lot of challenges that get or you know, inner city public schools anyway, a lot of challenges that get presented there as well. And it's always the kind of bureaucratic stuff or politics stuff that I hear teachers complain about more so than you know, whatever challenges the students presented.
I have a lot of teacher friends. Three of my good close friends are teachers, and my mom is a teacher. So I hear about all of that stuff. And I mean, this is an elementary school. Being in an elementary school as a male, there's not a lot of men. I was one of, I think, three males in my school, like teacher, you know, faculty in the school. So we were kind of like seen as peacekeepers in a lot of situations, which was strange, especially in my classroom. We had four or five other, you know, the teacher and then other assistants. And
like you were expected to break up fights?
Not break up fights, but just kind of like when two people were like two adults were not happy with each other and they were like arguing, it was kind of like I was the one that was like, well, what do you think? Who do you think is right here? Like that kind of thing. And I mean, our principal was a male. And so I kind of had, they always wanted me to go to him. Well, we have a problem with this teacher or this faculty. Like you got to go to him. And you know, and that wasn't, I wasn't into that whole thing. So I wanted to just, you know, hang out with the kids and have fun, and, you know, do our thing. Cause that was a lot of fun, you know, getting to know these kids and work with them and see them improve throughout the years, which was really cool.
I mean, I guess related to that, it kind of surprises me how many people have come from a teaching background into poker. I mean, we had one guest actually who's still a teacher in Canada, but also a pretty serious poker player. But the more, like, I initially I thought of it as kind of a rare thing, but the more I find out about poker players' backgrounds, it seems like there's a fair number of people who sort of started off in teaching and then just, you know, the job didn't turn out to be what they thought it was going to be or something. And I mean, obviously when poker comes along and you're like, well, I'm not really getting the satisfaction that I was looking for from teaching anyway, and the money's going to be a lot better in poker, and I'm sure, you know, all the other perks that come along with poker as well, maybe it's not such a hard decision.
Yeah, I think I would have enjoyed teaching older kids more, like high school level. I think that's where I would have fit in well. Like that would have been cool, I think, but maybe in 10 years we'll see what happens. I always say with poker, I play it year by year, and just this is what I'm doing now, and we'll see what happens. You know, I obviously have plans for the future, but you can only plan so much when you're in the poker world. You know, you don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. We all learn that after Black Friday, you know. So,
well, how did you start playing poker? Just, you know, do you remember like the first time, the first hand of poker you ever played? I mean, not the details, obviously, but
we used to play when I was a kid growing up. We had, you know, like just plastic chips, and we used to play all the games that the crazier games with wild cards, and we played guts and follow the queen, all those types of variants, and
like with your family,
five card draw. No, more with my friends. Okay. My family, my dad liked blackjack, but he was never really into poker. He never, I don't know why. Like I always wanted to play five card draw, and he never really wanted to play with me. He wanted to play something else. But we played growing up. I'm thinking like maybe like 8th, 9th grade, that type of, you know, like 12, 13 years old in that range was where we kind of started playing like once in a while. We wouldn't really play for money, I don't think, but we started playing for like nickels and pennies. Like everyone would bring $2 and you'd play with, you know, pennies and nickels and stuff. And that was how we started getting into it. And as we got older, we used to play Texas Hold'em. We had one friend who was like, now I'm talking now we're like probably 14, 15, who was like, oh, Texas Hold'em, we got to play Texas Hold'em. And so when it was his choice to pick the game, we would play literally one hand of Texas Hold'em. And it was, you know, most hands of Hold'em are pretty boring. It just folds around, or like one person raises and everybody takes it. Or it wasn't an exciting game, so nobody really liked it. It wasn't until that we, you know, really got into end of high school, even college, that anyone really started getting into Hold'em and watching it on TV and stuff like that. And I graduated high school in 2003. So this was, you know, right around the moneymaker time, and this is when it was on TV, and we started watching it and playing along with while we watched it on TV. So that was really what started it. But I think I would have stumbled into poker one way or another. And everyone likes to say moneymaker. I mean, I was really into just cards and stuff. I was into blackjack. That blackjack was pretty cool. I read the book about the MIT blackjack team, like, you know, years before the movie came out. And I thought that was like the coolest thing ever. And I was a really big pool player. I played really a lot of pool in high school and college. So I can't imagine how I wouldn't have eventually found a poker table in those settings.
You still shoot pool?
Not so much anymore. When I get a chance, I always like to, but between playing and traveling, and I have a 2-year-old daughter, like I just don't have a lot of time to, you know, head to a pool hall and play. So
it used to be that I was really confused at how such a sort of physically demanding game like pool can prepare somebody for poker. Then I sort of took up the game a little bit myself, and now I understand a lot better. Could you talk? I mean, do you think that pool helped you in your poker career?
One of the things that pool helped me with. So, okay. One of the things about poker that people really struggle with is playing either big pots or playing deep in a tournament and playing under a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
And kind of my whole life, I've been set up in these different pressure situations and expected to perform really well. Growing up as a kid, I played, you know, sports and I played hockey. I was a goalie for an ice hockey team and like, you know, like a travel team. And I played for years. So it was like a lot of situations were on me and there was a lot of pressure. Like, you have to, you know, stop the puck, otherwise we're going to lose. And that was always, I remember being really stressed, and I didn't realize it at the time, but I was really stressed. But I got over it, you know, and that's kind of led me in, you know, when I was playing pool and you have to take these really big pressure shots where it's like, you know what, your opponent is doing really well. And if you don't make this shot, you're probably going to lose this game. And having to stay calm and, you know, prevent yourself from doing things like shaking or just blowing the shot. And those aspects really have helped me in poker where, you know, when I'm deep in a tournament, when there's a really big cash game pot brewing, you know, I don't get nervous and I'm able to think clearly and stick to my game plan and not back down from that moment. And I think that's really helped me just in poker in general. Also with pool, I've been a big fan of strategy games just in general, growing up and even now. And I always loved the strategy of pool. I was always a very defensive player, and that helped me play against people that were better than me, but maybe weren't as smart. Yeah. Like, they could hit the shots, but they would just hit the ball way too hard, and they would wind up believing themselves kind of poorly sometimes. And I was a very, very, just hit the ball very softly and would always be really thinking about how to prevent them from being able to run the table. So I could set myself up to run the table, like that type of thing. And I think that helped me a lot. I played pool in college against people that were way better than me and fared fairly well because of this. And I mean, better mechanically.
Yeah. In terms of like learning how to deal with pressure, coming from, you know, the background in pool, for instance, was that just a matter of experience, or was there something in particular that you learned to do to deal with nerves in those kind of high pressure situations?
I think it was just experience for me, because especially coming from, you know, playing hockey growing up, I almost became immune to those situations, the high pressure. And I don't know if it's a matter of not understanding the gravity of the situation. Like, sometimes, you know, I'll be deep in a tournament and first is a lot of money, and someone will come up to me afterwards and be like, oh my God, like, I couldn't have played. I don't know how you did that. I don't know how you bluffed. And I'm like, what do you, like, I was just playing a hand of poker. Like, I don't know. It's just another hand. I don't think of things in the like big picture sometimes. It's not like, oh, if I win this tournament, I can buy a new house. That's, you know, that's not the way you do make correct decisions. And it's kind of the same thing with pool. Like, I used to just go to the rec center in college and just throw all the balls on the table and just try to knock them in as little shots as possible just by myself, you know, and set up these drills where I would just basically try to run tables. And it was just another shot. You know, every single shot I took was just another, like, you've done this shot a million times, just do it again and move on to the next one. You know, I would never let situations get like inside my head too much. Does that make sense? Is that clear what I'm
I think it's clear anyway, and I think the parallels to poker are pretty obvious as well in terms of how you ought to be thinking about particular hands of poker and in terms of how many people actually think about them.
Yeah, yeah. People get really wrapped up in the, you know, how much am I getting paid? Where does this place get paid? There's a pay jump in two spots. I should fold this. You know, like, just relax, play your hand, and yeah, you want to consider payouts. There's ICM and all that, but you know, you're just playing one hand at a time, you know, and that's what it comes down to in so many spots.
Well, and just like getting so wrapped up, even in a cash game, or maybe more so in a cash game, with whether or not they win a particular pot. You know, like if you know, obviously, like there are many situations where it's correct for you to increase the likelihood that you'll lose the pot in order to, you know, increase your long-term expected value as well. And how many more amateurish players will get just very upset if they, you know, they had the best hand and then they didn't by the river and think, oh, I should have done something differently.
There's so many even regs that, you know, you say like your overall long-term expectation where they get to a river and they're like, oh my God, I missed my draw, or I only have, you know, my hand is only not very good. I need to bluff. I need to win this pot. And there's so many pots that you just don't, you're not designed to win the pot with that hand. It's okay to give up sometimes, but people don't seem to like to do that. That's a very human nature thing, is they don't want to give up. They don't want to lose any pot.
Yeah, I was thinking about this the other day, actually. People kind of get that preflop, there are certain things that you just aren't going to be able to do, like, you know, opening seven deuce offsuit under the gun. It's not really like table dependent, it's not read dependent, it's not image dependent, it's just not really something you're going to be able to do profitably. Yeah. And but then, like, when it comes to later streets, a lot of people are way more willing to ignore that. Well, they'll just, like you said, they'll just bluff with any hand on the river just because it doesn't have any showdown value, or just kind of throwing all that out the window when it comes to later streets.
They just don't like losing big pots, is all it comes down to. And especially when you're, you know, a cash game player, like, you're just going to lose big pots. It's part of the game. It's just like when you get kings and someone has aces, you're going to lose a buy-in. Like, it's the same thing on certain board runouts, and when you have certain hands, you're just going to lose.
Well, and like live poker, those individual hands, I mean, I think that's part of the issue, is you don't really reach the long run in live poker. So it feels like, and it does actually make a big difference sometimes whether or not you win a particular large pot, but that doesn't mean that you can, you know, do anything about that. It's just
exactly,
it's just the case. What was your process for getting better at poker? Did you start playing online when you were in college?
I started playing online sometime in college. I played Play Money on Poker Room. I remember I hated Play Money because no one played seriously. Everyone was like limping every hand or shoving every hand. And you could tell it wasn't real play. But I discovered that in the sit and goes, especially they ran all these like higher buy-in Play Money sit and goes, people played like real seriously because you were, you know, they started you with 1,000 or 2,000 chips and in Play Money chips. And these were like, you know, 50K Play Money chip buy-ins, and people like had a lot of Play Money chips and they were taking them pretty seriously. So I used to play those, and I ran my Play Money up into the millions, and, you know, I was all happy about that. And then somebody said, like, oh, you know, there's this party poker, like, you know, why don't we like put 20 bucks on each and try to make some money? And we did, and I think I lost my 20 bucks. And then someone told me about Poker Stars, and they're like, oh, I have money on Poker Stars. And I played $5 sit and go, which is really I have no memory really of the party poker experience. I remember playing on Poker Stars though, the sit and go. I played Omaha. I can't imagine why I thought that was a good idea, and I won the sit and go, and I was like really excited, like, oh, I won the first ever tournament I ever played for money. And I don't think I ever really looked back. Like, I deposited a few times, but I was always a really big, like, really big bankroll nit. This is back in, again, to like 2004, 2005, where there weren't really low, 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 low stakes. Like, I think $5 buy-ins were a lot of the lowest sit and goes you could play at the time. Mm-hmm. So if I had like 50 bucks and I won a $5 sit and go for like 40 bucks or whatever, I used to play like 18 or 45 mans. I don't remember what they paid. I used to like instantly withdraw like almost all my money and then only leave like 20 bucks on and try to run that back up. So I was inevitably going broke with my four buy-in bankroll and having to put some of that money that I had already withdrew back online. The sites must have hated me for how many times I withdrew like 50 bucks and deposited 20 and then withdrew 50 and deposited 20. But yeah, I loved sit and goes. Those were like the things that I played. I played almost exclusively sit and goes for so long. And then I got into MTTs. And that's
what appealed to you about sit and goes?
I don't know, honestly. In the beginning, I don't know why I picked those. I think it just started from playing the Play Money ones. I had read some books and I developed an okay sit and go strategy where I would just play really tight. And then when I got shorthanded, I would kind of be more aggressive. I remember reading, I read Super System, like forever ago, and I remember there was one thing that stuck out to me about like the way Doyle explains, like, kind of being aggressive with, like, big draws and stuff like that, where you, like, bet and then you just kind of keep betting and then you just go all in the river. And the way that stack sizes, like, worked in a single, you start with 1,500 chips, you could, like, bet the flop, bet the turn, and then be all in on the river. And I used to just do that a lot, and people used to fold. So I was, like, really aggressive right off the bat, which is almost out of character for me in a lot of regards. It was, like, I've seen a few of us a while ago emailed PokerStars and got the hand histories from some of the earliest tournaments we've ever played on the site.
Oh, that's a cool idea.
And this was over the summer in Vegas, actually. So, like, three or four of us did it, and we, like, put it up on a TV in Vegas, and we were, like, looking at it and just, like, laughing at how we played poker, you know, 10 years ago. And one of the first MTTs I played, I was, like, a maniac. I was doing the weirdest things, like, the weirdest aggressive things. And that's just what made me, I think, do okay. Because everyone was so generally so tight back then. But I like the fact that, you know, you could have, like, a defined strategy in a sit and go. Mm-hmm. Whereas a cash game, I felt like I didn't know what I was doing with different hands. I had no strategy. Like, try to play tight and make big hands and make money. I didn't know. It didn't make sense to me. Whereas a tournament, I understood I was battling these people. I need to get all the chips. I can do that. Mm-hmm. I'll play tight. And then when it gets shorter, I'll use my tight image and the blinds get big and I'll just raise a lot and win all the chips, and it kind of worked. So that was, like, what I really liked about tournaments.
It sounds very similar to my own experience, and I remember thinking specifically about sit and goes that I was like, well, all I have to do, I don't even have to win, I don't have to get all the chips, I just have to outlast, like, six of these idiots. And
yeah, and you, and you then can do I that by something. Just folding the first three hands.
Yeah. So sorry, I cut you off. You were starting to talk about a transition to MTTs.
Yeah, I just, you know, after a while, sit and goes, I don't know if they get boring, or for me, I was playing, this is now, I'm, like, kind of exercising some amount of better bankroll management. I had, like, I was still only playing, like, 5, 10, and occasional $20 sit and goes, mostly 18 and 45 mans, and the occasional, like, 180 man on stars.
How did the idea of bankroll management even come into your consciousness? Were you on 2+2 or some other?
I was petrified of, like, losing my money, basically. I never wanted to be a losing player. So my goal was always, like, to figure out a way to not be a losing player. So I used to just, I had $50. I would play $5 sit and goes. When I got to 100, I would play $10 sit and goes. This is clearly not great strategy, but it was something.
It's better than what a lot of people were doing.
Exactly. And like I said, anytime I made money, like, whenever I got my bankroll to $150, I would withdraw 100 and go back to 50, and I go back to $5, and I would just start again. And I just did this over and over and over. Like, in hindsight, it was silly, but my goal was, I always wanted to withdraw more than I was possibly losing. So if I withdrew one time, I could lose that $50 twice and still be breaking even. Like, that was my mindset, which, again, in hindsight, it's not a great mindset to have. Like, you know, if I kept playing and moving up, I probably would have made a lot more money back then, but I didn't know I was really good and I wasn't that into it. I was just kind of thing to do between classes because I hated college. It was boring to me. But no, I wasn't really on 2+2 yet. I met a couple of people that just used to play the sit and goes a lot, and we exchanged, like, aims, and we used to just talk and, like, play the same sit and goes. And I was only playing a hand. I was playing, like, you know, I would do, like, a session. A session for me was I register for an 18, a 27, and a 45 man for, like, $5 and then for $10. And they would, whenever they filled, I would play them. I would generally not be playing more than three or four tables at a time. And when those six tournaments were done, I was, like, done. I would decide if I wanted to play another session. And me and this guy used to do this, like, every night, play these $10 tournaments. And it was cool, like, having someone to say, hey, that was a good tournament we played. Oh, we both cashed this one, you know. And that's how I kind of started. And I think he might have told me about Pocket Fives. Pocket Fives was the first site I really found back in, again, probably 2000. I could probably actually look when I created my Pocket Fives account, but I'm going to say 2007 or so. Mm. And yeah, 2007, it looks like.
So I've cut you off twice now from talking about.
That's okay. I think I've cut you off too. What was I?
You were transitioning to MTTs.
Transitioning to MTTs. Yeah, I don't know. It just, after 45 mans, I started playing 180 mans, and I just kind of, like, as I was getting better at poker, I was realizing that I can play in, like, bigger person tournaments and still have a general similar strategy and do well of, like, playing tight in the beginning and more aggressive later on. And I just started playing, like, I started playing the $3 rebuy and some $10 rebuys and stuff like that. Just, I remember there was a $5 freeze-out I really liked, and I just started playing MTTs. It just seemed like the next logical step to me. And that was really what I loved playing those. I used to rush home from class. There was no late reg or like a minute of late reg back then. Mm-hmm. And I used to rush home from my last class to get into three rebuy. That was like the tournament that I loved the most because she had, you know, some chips and it was only like $9 and it was great. And big first prize back then, it was like, you know, $7,000 or whatever. And maybe it wasn't that much, 6,000, 5,000. But yeah, MTTs were it for me. I was sold. I was getting more aggressive too. I learned that like you can just steal the blinds a lot and people folded. So anytime I made the antes, I would like make a run back then. It was unbelievable how tight people were in those big fields. And I just started moving up. I started doing well. I in 2007, I chopped the first tournament ever. I chopped some $11 six max heads up. Interesting.
Not the first tournament you played.
No. First this play. Is like the first, like my first big score was, yes. It was like for like $1,200 or something in a $10 tournament. I was a college kid. I had like a job. I worked like one day a week or something in a music store. I had like no money and I was in the photography and I really wanted a digital camera, like a nice digital camera. And I was looking around and this one store was running this like special on this really nice Nikon digital camera. It's usually like a $900 camera and they had it for like $700 or something like that. And I only had like, I mean, maybe like $900 to my name. And I don't know why, but I thought it was a good idea to buy this camera. So I got
so much for bankroll management.
Yeah, exactly. It's just horrible decision making in hindsight as a college kid. And I was like, well, I don't know what I'm going to have no money for the next like 2 months now as I try to work this off. And the following day, I chopped that tournament for $1,200, and I was so excited. I took my two roommates out. We got dinner, and then my roommate, she's like, "Oh, I guess there's that camera, you know? You just pay for your camera." I'm like, "Yep, there we go." So it worked out.
Did you end up getting good use out of the camera?
I did. I was really into photography for a while. I took a bunch of classes, and I still have it.
I can imagine some alternate universe right now where you're a professional photographer on a photography podcast telling the same story about how you spent $700 on the camera. The best decision I ever made. It seemed stupid at the time, but it was actually genius.
Seriously. Or there's another alternative universe where maybe my poker playing is not as good and I become the a media guy taking pictures of the poker players.
Yeah.
I could have worked out too, but I have the camera. It's actually right here on my desk. It's still a phenomenal camera because it was like top of the line back then. It's got a great lens and a great sensor, and it still takes better pictures than 95% of cameras on the market right now. So,
are you still into photography?
Not so much, but I still kind of feel like I have the desire to take pictures. And when I'm outside with my daughter and our dogs, I'm the guy like laying on the ground, like trying to get a nice shot and trying to frame the sun in the corner or this and the, you know. So I still have a interest in it, but it's just it's pretty far down the list as far as things I have time for now and you know, interest. So
how has the daughter affected the poker schedule and interest and whatnot?
Well, okay, so let me take a
step. I know we're taking a big jump here, so feel
free. Yeah, we're taking a big jump, and I think that this is going to progress better if I stick to the timeline here. So this is partially my fault because I'm scatterbrained and I jump around. But so I'm playing MTTs. I was, like I said, a big bankroll nit. I was afraid of going broke. My mom always, from a very young age, like instilled in me that like gambling is bad. My father used to like bet on sports, and I like not so successfully, I'm pretty sure. And I think that that's where this came from. But anyway, so when I was a kid playing poker one night, I lost, I think like $20 or $40. Like this is when we were playing for like $2 or $4. We were older. We were in like high school probably. But I had lost like $40 one night playing poker. It was the most I ever lost by a ton. And my mom found out and was like really upset. Like you can't, you know, this is like bad. Gambling is bad, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I was okay. We were all just having fun. Like, you know, pots got big and we're just messing around, you know. And so this was like kind of in the back of my head, I think, looking back. So I was so afraid of moving up in stakes and MTTs. And at this point, you know, we're getting into like 2008 or 2009 almost. And I've got a lot of money. I've got like a five-figure bankroll on stars, but I'm still afraid to play bigger buy-in. I'm afraid to play like Sunday Mill and stuff like that. I'm thinking like, oh, you know, I'm going to go broke if I go on a downswing. I see Pocket Fives, these MTT guys talking about going on 50K downswings. I'm like, oh my God, like this, I can't lose this money. This is all the money I have in my life. So I really wanted to get backed. And I had a couple friends that I met through, you know, Pocket Fives and through just other friends and stuff. And my one friend goes, oh, you're looking for a backer, right? Like just one day. And I'm like, yeah, I want to get backed for stuff. And so he goes, oh, my buddy, I'm buddies with Dipthrong. Do you know him? I'm like, no, I don't know who that is. And so he's like, oh, he backs a bunch of guys. He's like, let me give you his Skype or your AIM. This is AIM back then. And so the conversation literally goes, Dipthrong is Mark Herm, like the MTT, famous MTT guy for those that don't know. Super successful and still playing and doing great now. But anyway, he messages me and goes, oh, you need a backer. You want a backer? I'm like, yeah. He goes, okay, cool, I'll back you. And I'm like, okay.
That was the extent.
Okay, cool, I'll send you money tomorrow. I'm like, okay, this is it? Like, this is that's it? And that was basically it. It was very informal. And I started getting backed by him, and I started playing literally like every MTT that ran, and I started doing well. This was 2009. And I was backed by him for like 4 or 5 years. After Black Friday, I did nothing for basically a year. I played a little bit live. And just was deciding what to do with my life. I took a couple of trips. I went to an EPT at the end of 2011 and decided, like, I really need to play online again. So my then girlfriend at the time was like, all right, well, let's just move to Canada. She quit her job. We got married and we moved to Canada. And we were there for like 5 or 6 months. And we spent all of 2012 just like traveling around. And she came to the World Series with me. We went to Europe, to a couple EPTs. I just played all over the place. And I had some makeup with Dipthrong still. At the time of Black Friday, I was on one of the biggest downswings ever, actually, at that time, right when Black Friday hit. So I went up to Canada with like a massive pile of makeup. And I wound up getting rid of all of it while I was up there and, you know, doing pretty well. And then I had a lot of success at the end of 2012 playing live in Prague. I found a table at WPT and chopped a side event for I don't even know a lot, and that was what kind of like sparked everything. I left Mark at that point and went on my own, and I started playing just everything. I started playing more live, a lot more live in 2012 and 13. I played a ton live, but anyway, so 2013 it was when poker in New Jersey was kind of starting to come around, and there was like legislation, and it seemed like it was going to happen. This is regulated poker in New Jersey. And my wife was pregnant in, I guess, like February or March of 2013. And it looked like poker was coming by the end of the year. So I was like, all right, well, let's try to make this work here. And I'll just stay here. And so we bought a house here. And I played, like I said, a ton in 2013, traveling all over. And then once my daughter was born in October, I just stayed home, and I took a month off when she was first born, and then poker started in the end of November in New Jersey, regulated poker, and I pretty much have just played these sites since then. I still take trips for like, you know, the big stars events like WCOOP, Scoops, and, you know, Vegas and stuff like that, but for the most part, I just play on these regulated sites now.
Nice.
Yeah.
Where did you go in Canada when you relocated there?
Toronto. Yeah. We loved it. Toronto was like really, really awesome experience for us.
So what made you decide to it sounds like you didn't return to Toronto, though. The next year you ended up traveling around Europe instead.
Pretty much. I played a couple EPTs. I did go, like, I've been back to Toronto numerous times for different series and stuff like that. Like, I spent all of September for WCOOP there a couple times, stuff like that. But Toronto, I don't know what, it just was the closest city, basically. We could drive there. And it seemed like kind of cool. I don't know. Where else was I going to go? I wasn't going to go to Montreal with like and deal with like the French. Like, I don't know French at all. You know, I wasn't going to deal with that. And it was like a little further from me from where I am. And Toronto was just the next logical like step. This, it was right there. It's super close.
Yeah, Montreal is where I went first, and the French ended up being a bigger deal than I thought it was going to be. I mean, I think it depends a lot on what neighborhood you're in, and I do actually speak some French, although understand, I mean, my French was never that great, and it was old, and the Montreal accent is quite different, or the dialect or whatever is quite different, but my girlfriend in particular felt pretty out of place there. Like, she couldn't really just you know, go about her daily life. So we ended up going elsewhere.
Yeah, I don't know what made me pick Toronto. I think it was just the closest, honestly. Mm-hmm. And we wound up loving it. We brought our dog up there, and it was awesome. There were so many nice parks and stuff. We had a really nice time. I since have a friend who now goes to graduate school in Calgary, a friend from New Jersey, my college friend actually, who now lives in Canada. So whenever I want to go anywhere now, I just go and stay with her. So it's I have a place to have to fly to Calgary, but it's nice to have a place to stay and someone that I know there and stuff like that. So.
How did you take to live poker? When did you start doing that seriously? After Black Friday?
I've always played. Like, I remember playing.
Oh, you were in New Jersey, so I guess you could always just shoot over to Atlantic City, huh?
Yeah, I went there. Once I started getting backed by Dipthrong, he was willing to put me into, like almost anything live. So I started, you know, expanding more because, again, being the bankroll nit, I was always afraid to even spend $300-$500 on a tournament. I was never very good. I think I was like made a lot of mistakes looking back. Like I totally would do things that I would consider standard online that were just really bad for live, whether it was against the type of player or just things that you shouldn't do, like reshoving 30 big blinds that are just like unnecessary, like things like that, that people were doing back in the day online that you just never saw live, and ranges were so different that I was just not faring well doing it. Mm-hmm. I was very impatient, I think. It was such a big change compared to playing so fast online for all that time. But after Black Friday, I never had good live results basically until after Black Friday, partially because of this. And I started playing a little bit live cash. There was a casino like a half hour from me in Pennsylvania. And I never liked that. I was never a fan of like playing live cash. It's just very boring to me. But once I started playing, I had no online to play anymore. I kind of had no choice but to like learn to get better at live tournaments. And so that's what I think, like taking some of those trips, playing some EPTs really taught me, like you can play your game and just learn to adjust versus these guys and, you'll do better. So it was definitely a slow transition to live for me. I did fairly poorly in the beginning. And I feel like I'm much more comfortable now. Like I can see the things that people are doing. I'm very content just like folding and, you know, playing tight when it's called for and not making these, trying to make people fold top pair, which they're clearly not going to do, you know, and I don't punt tournaments anymore, basically.
Specific aha moments in tournaments that you remember? Like any live tournament specific aha moments that stick out in your memory?
Not really, I guess. One of the things about live, that the biggest thing about live poker that made me think, like, the big, I guess, aha type of spot was when I realized that I was forcing things where, like, I would have, let's say, 25 big blinds, and it would be a spot where maybe online I'd be like, oh, let me try to sneak this early position open through and try to pick up some chips. That just doesn't work live when, like, there's these guys who are just calling everything behind you and you go five ways to a flop. Like, I would try to do stuff like that sometimes, and it looks horrendous looking back on it, and I just kind of played tighter basically, and that helped me like so much, and just especially from early position and not putting yourself in awkward spots and things that seem very obvious that online you can get away with in certain situations because the table is tight or because it's a close to a bubble or whatever it is, whereas live I was trying to do this like in the early and mid stages because I was like, oh, I want some chips, and it just doesn't work, and that was when I realized I was doing that. I felt really kind of dumb, and I changed that, and I instantly started doing much better in live poker.
How about dealing specifically with, you mentioned being kind of impatient with the pace of live poker compared to online. Is there anything in particular that you had to do to accustom yourself to that? I mean, other than just getting the experience?
I tried numerous things. I tried listening to music. I tried just like reading stuff online or whatever, or watching movies. I used to do that sometimes. I then tried completely like, you know, no distractions. I'm like, let's just focus on the table. Let's try to talk to people. Let's try to watch what they're doing, you know, all that stuff. I think a combination of those things is what's best. When you have a nice table, like I really enjoy just kind of hanging out and just talking with other people that are willing to talk and that are friendly. And when the table's quiet and it's kind of a boring table or it's very early in a tournament and it's, you know, you don't feel like talking. I just like putting headphones on and I listen to like a podcast or something like that. I found that podcasts are actually much better for me than music because I can, the time seems to go faster. Whereas like I'm more into that, yet I can very quickly just pause it and put it down and come back to it for a hand and that type of thing. Music is a little more like draining on me, I feel like, when I'm just listening and time isn't passing and I'm bored, like that type of thing. Like that's not, music's not going to make that go much faster, you know. But the podcast seems to help that a lot. So I like that. It gives me a nice level of focus, I feel like. Keeps my brain active too, instead of just zoning out.
What are your three favorite podcasts?
I listen to the Hello Internet podcasts like a lot. It's CGP Grey is a YouTube personality with Brady Harron's and their YouTube personality. They both make really awesome videos on YouTube, and they both just kind of just talk about stuff. And they're both really smart, and that's definitely my favorite one. I don't really – I'm not like a big listener to like whole other series. I tend to just bounce around. Like for example, I really – was into the new Star Wars movie. I thought that was really cool. So I just like listened to like 10 different podcasts about the movie and about Star Wars in general and that type of stuff. So I'm more kind of like whatever I'm into in the moment, I just do like a search on and then find something and just listen to those. That's kind of the style I like to go.
How did you get fixed up with Party Poker in New Jersey?
Borgata Poker.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, well, that's right. Okay,
so Borgata and Party, they're the same network, they're the same software, but their like promotions and their and stuff are different.
Okay. Yeah, I started to be like, wait, aren't they the same? And I was like, he probably wouldn't have corrected you if they were the same.
it's a little confusing because people do look at like everything says Borgata/Party. But the software promotions, reward points, all that stuff is separate. So Party Poker actually has a couple of their pros, like Jamie Kerstetter and I think Scott Baumstein. And Borgata Poker has, you know, their own group of pros, which is like me, Ash, Vinny, Matt Stout. I think that's it. I don't know. I knew a couple people at Borgata just from going there a lot. I was asked to commentate one of the live streams they had, the final tables they do now. And I just started meeting a couple people that, you know, work at Borgata in the live room. And then I was told to meet with the guy who runs the online program because he's looking for suggestions and this type of stuff. And we just got to talking. And he was really interested in streaming on Twitch because that's obviously like a big thing for poker. And there's a lot of people that are, you know, doing it now. And he was asking me if I'd be interested in, you know, streaming some Borgata events for him, basically. Some online tournaments and stuff. And I said, you know, sure, like, let's work something out. And we wound up settling on me becoming a pro. And I now stream for Borgata. You can check out my stream on Twitch. I just stream under Gags30. And I do it generally three days a week, 3-4 days a week. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday usually. But I do – you can check out Regulated Poker. It's pretty awesome.
You enjoy the Twitching?
I do. It took a little bit of getting used to. Because it was very distracting in the beginning. I cut a few tables actually to get like, you know, like reading a chat and like working the streaming program and like worrying about, you know, the mic and the camera's not working right and all this stuff. So it was definitely distracting in the beginning, but I've got a nice routine down and I'm very comfortable. I can play like a large number of tables now while I stream and still interact with people and stuff like that. And I feel like it's a lot of fun. I was hesitant because especially being in New Jersey, the like player pool is fairly small. Mm. And I don't play, like I play a lot more cash games now. Once poker started in New Jersey, like they're just, I mean, it's just very hard to make a living playing just MTTs because there's just not that many. So I kind of started supplementing with cash games and I like was like, I don't know about streaming cash games because I play with a lot of regs and they're gonna be able to, you know, see what I'm doing in different spots. But I'm less worried about that now. You know, I just kind of play my game. I stream mostly the lower stakes tables that I'm playing where there's less regs. Let's put it that way.
And you don't, I mean, it's not hard for me to imagine you kind of holding court on Twitch, but you don't find that to be real exhausting, having to kind of entertain people and play at the same time?
One of the things that I've learned is that, like, I'm not an entertainer. Like, I can be entertaining, but I'm not one of those guys. Like, there's so many guys on Twitch that are like, yeah, pocket jacks, here we go. Like, that's just not going to be me, you know? I'm not going to get all emotional when I win or lose a tournament. It's just, you know, we're going to get it in and I'm going to get sucked out on and I'm going to lose and that's that. You know, I'm not going to yell and cry about it or throw things. And so I'm not going to be one of those guys. If you're coming to Twitch looking for that, you're just not going to get it with me. So once I realized that, like, I don't need to talk like 100% of the time and there can be silence and people can just kind of watch me play and listen to the music. And people seem to like the music I play. I try to play a very varied playlist to appeal to everyone and it seems to be working. Like, you know, between watching me play and listening to the music and then being able to just interact and talk about some stuff, like that's the experience that I give to people. You know, it's like a more relaxing, like you kick back on a Sunday while you're playing your MTTs and you watch me play and you get to hear and we get to talk about some issues that come up or anything that comes up, you know, but I'm not going to be there. I'm not the whole show, you know, that type of thing.
It's funny because this show has been compared to public radio before. And I think Andrew and I both figured out somewhere in the first 10 episodes that we were what we were and we were not any other poker podcast. We were not yelling and screaming, and some people probably thought we weren't very entertaining at all. And I don't know, would you say that's accurate, Andrew, that it's, you know, we early on we figured out this is who we were, and
it's just like you're never going to be more entertaining than like Stapes and or, you know, it's like professional entertainers.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not going to be Sticky Rice dancing in the other room while I'm slow rolling somebody, you know. That's just not going to happen. But people really enjoy it, you know, and in the beginning I was really worried, like, oh my God, I'm not – like, I got to talk more and I got to, like, make more jokes. And it just – that is – no, that's not how it works. And me not speaking a lot seems to actually not bother anyone. People like that they can just ask me questions and then I'm like, hey, oh, you got a question? Sure, I'll answer that question. We can talk about that. When I have something I want to talk about, we discuss it. We discuss all the – I'm sure we're going to talk – I'll talk tonight while I stream about – Espandiari getting kicked out of the PCA tournament, you know, stuff like that. Like whatever comes up.
If you have thoughts on that, I'd be curious to hear them now as well.
I mean, it's just silly. I think did something very stupid and shouldn't have done that, you know.
Like, for the sake of our listeners who don't know what happened, would you give a quick summary?
He, as far as I know, now there's have no official statements, so most of this is based on things that I've read on Twitter from various people. So he's in this prop bet with Bill Perkins that he has to lunge everywhere, like instead of walking, like, you know, like lunges for 2 days for, I believe it was for 50K is what I heard the prop bet was. So this is like near the end of the second day and his legs are like extremely, extremely sore and he's in the PCA main near the end of day two. And he really had to go to the bathroom and he's like, I can't lunge to the bathroom. Like, I just don't physically think I can do it. I need to save my energy to be able to get back to my room. So he peed in either a cup or a bottle while he was at the table. And that, like, clearly is frowned upon. he got kicked out of the tournament. They disqualified him from the tournament. I mean, in retrospect, like, if that happened in the U.S., like, he could have, like, definitely gotten arrested or, sure, like, been a sex offender, like who knows, like, you know, there's all kinds of crazy stuff that could have happened as a result of doing that, something like that. Like, that was a very big lapse of judgment on my part, but yeah, I don't know, kind of silly.
Well, we should make sure we get around to talking about your coaching and some of the more successful people that you've coached. You've mentioned that your students have run well.
I started coaching fairly early in my career, I'd say. Sometime in 2009, I started coaching. So I was just really breaking through in tournaments. I considered myself proficient at lower stakes MTTs, but not so much higher ones because I hadn't played that many. But I had a bunch of people messaging me, asking me about coaching, like on Pocket Fives and stuff, because I posted a lot. So I think they were like, oh, this guy knows what he's talking about. I think that's where I appealed to people. And I finally decided, like, all right, I'll just coach some people. And I coached a couple guys, and my first student ever, we did some lessons. And then, you know, the way people do coaching, for those that have never experienced like poker coaching, most players in my experience, they come to you and they're like, I want some lessons. And I'm like, okay, let's do some lessons. And we'll do anywhere from, I don't know, 1 to 10 lessons is probably the average, I'd say, of an hour each. And then I don't hear from people for a long time. And then sometimes never. Sometimes they just take a few lessons and then I never hear from them again. And then other people take lessons, play for 6 months, take some more lessons, play for 6 months, like that type of thing. So this guy took a handful of lessons. I don't remember how many. I didn't hear from him for a couple of months. And then I said, you know what? There's this big FTOP series coming up. I want to take some more lessons. You know, I want to get ready to play these tournaments. And we did some more lessons. And then he was very happy. And he went on to chop the FTOP's main event. And he was, you know, that was obviously a super great result for him. And he was super excited. He thanked me like a million times for, he said he wouldn't have, you know, like all the stuff we talked about. And I'm like, yeah, hey, you did it, man. You know, not me. You put in the work. You know, that's what I'm here for. So that was my first real success with one of my students. And then I coached numerous people. A lot of them gone on to become like really good MTT regs. I don't necessarily take credit for what they've gone on to accomplish because I coached them when they were, you know, in the younger stages of their playing. But I like to think that I, you know, had an impact on them.
Put them off on the right foot anyway.
Exactly. I mean, like, yeah, like I say that I coached someone that went on to win the main event. I coached Joe McKeon like back in 2000, maybe 10 or 11. I don't even remember, honestly, but he was an MTT reg and he wasn't doing so well. And we did some lessons and I kind of set him straight for the time being. And he wound up doing quite well the rest of the, you know, that year. Was it a result of me? You know, I'm not sure. I certainly won't take credit for his main event win, but it's nice that, you know, someone that I coached that stuck around poker, hopefully because of me, maybe, I don't know, went on to accomplish such great things, you know.
Were you there at the final table? Did you help him prepare for it at all?
I did not. I am friends with him. I talked to him, you know, a lot, and I was planning on going, but I had a family matter that I couldn't not be here for. So I wound up having to cancel my trip and stay here. But I sweat him. I streamed on Twitch all three nights of the final table. And basically we just watched the stream and talked about it and sweat it and stuff. So that was super exciting. That was great. I was super happy for him watching him win.
Yeah, this is actually something that I wanted to ask you anyway. And then it occurs to me, I've actually heard, you know, people say this about Joe specifically. There's a lot of people, you know, who either joke or in some cases, you know, might actually mean it, you know, about a lot of poker players or some of the best poker players being somewhere on the autism spectrum. And I think mm-hmm. I have heard people, you know, speculate that about Joe as well. And I'm, you know, very suspicious of armchair psychology. I mean, is that something that upsets you as someone who has actually worked with actual diagnosed autistic children?
It doesn't upset me. I mean, here's the thing about autism in general is that it is a spectrum. So there's no like quite starting point and ending point, you know, like who's to say who is and who isn't exactly on the border. Maybe someone is on the border or maybe someone isn't on the border of being on the spectrum, you know. I think that people tend to not understand autism very much. They have like very big, not biases,
yeah, they're like just like so-and-so is awkward and very smart at this one thing, so he must be autistic.
Exactly. Anyone who's not like, you know, the belle of the ball is like, oh, they're autistic. They're not social enough. Like, that's not quite how it works. So, and I think a lot of people, especially sitting at home watching Joe on TV or on Twitter, you know, you just don't know. You know, you don't know what he's about and you don't know anything. And there's plenty of people that act very differently when they're in the spotlight than they do, you know, at home or with some friends and that type of thing. So it doesn't upset me. It just kind of, I know that people are ignorant and people don't know what they're talking about. So in a lot of situations, I see with poker all the time, you sit at a poker table with some rough and tough guy who thinks that he knows everything. And guess what? He's not very good at poker, but you know, so it's nothing new to me that people are talking about things they don't know about.
You made a vague reference earlier to having some plans for the future. Is there anything you want to elaborate on?
I think that I think goals in poker are often silly. You know, people say things like, I'm going to win two WSOP bracelets or I'm going to cash for $1 million. Like, that's variance. There's a lot of variance in MTTs especially. I have goals.
I wish I could fist bump you right now.
Yeah. I have goals in regards to what I want to do, like kind of off of the table. Like there's a few things I really want to work on my game in certain aspects. Certain aspects of my game, like I want to make sure I'm always improving in. And those are some things that I've, you know, sometimes slacked at in the past. And I've been very diligent in the last couple of years, especially being just in New Jersey, knowing that, you know, I'm not playing MTTs against the best people in the world anymore. I need to keep up with my game and make sure that I don't, you know, fall. So I've spent a lot of time, you know, working on stuff and watching videos and just countless hours going over hand histories and through my database and stuff like that. So I have goals like that, like I said, off of the table. I also have just things in, like I want to do as far as I want to make sure I play some live tournaments, which I can tend to be a little lazy, like traveling to. Especially, it's like I said, it's hard with my daughter, just, you know, always like leaving and stuff like that. I don't want to do that. But, you know, just getting down there, getting there on time, like that type of stuff. I have goals like that I'd like to accomplish. And I still would like to win a live tournament. That's a goal I'd love to win. but that's going to fall in the variance one. I've never won a live tournament, actually. I've gotten second numerous times for one reason or another. So that's
a closer. That's the problem.
I'd love to say that you know, I'm not great at heads up, and I may not be the best in the world at heads up, but I think I'm proficient enough to beat many of my opponents that I've played. Haven't had the right hands hold when they need to hold, it seems. But
that's going to fall into the stories people like to spin out of, you know, they grab a couple of data points and they're like, oh, so-and-so is a closer and this other guy, he's no good at heads up. And it's like, oh, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I just know, like, I play cash games a lot now online, and, like, I'm not a heads-up player, you know? Like, I know that. I'm much more proficient three-handed versus heads-up, like by a lot. But I've played so many countless MTTs, and I've clearly closed many MTTs in my day that I'm very proficient at shorter stacks of heads-up. And I feel that it's been variance, you know? And if I just keep playing more live tournaments, I'll bring one home eventually, so... I'm not worried about that, but let me get back to my daughter because I never got really a chance to talk about that. So once poker started, like I said, in New Jersey, I took a month off and then I started playing here, and it's been great. I mean, it was frustrating a little bit in the beginning because it was hard to like always play when she was kind of younger because I wanted to like help out and stuff, and I felt bad like just sitting there with my wife. Struggled while she was crying or whatever it was. But as she's gotten older, it's actually gotten easier because like she just understands now, like, oh, daddy's going to go work and I go downstairs and I play poker, and she's, you know, completely fine with that. And she's cool with it. But it's been awesome. She knows that I work on the computer, and that's about it, you know? We've a lot of fun, and I'm really fortunate to be able to be home with her all day and then be able to play poker like in the evenings, mostly when she's sleeping, you know? So I get to spend a good half of the day. I mean, I sleep later because I'm up late at night. Then they wake up super early in the morning, my wife and my daughter. But I still get to spend the whole afternoon with her, which is super awesome. And I'm really fortunate and thankful that I can get to do that.
And do you have like a set role? I mean, is your wife staying home with the daughter right now?
Yeah. She doesn't work.
So like, do you kind of take over from her at some point in the afternoon, like after you wake up and before you go to bed, you should get time off?
Yeah, I mean, like we spend the whole afternoon together. We usually either, my daughter likes to like get out of the house and like she's got to do a bunch of classes and stuff she goes to mostly in the morning with my wife. But there's a few in the afternoon. Like I'll take her to those sometimes. And just like we like to like, she takes a nap in the afternoon. So like I'll always like read with her a little bit before she goes to the nap. She likes to, you know, doing that like right after I wake up. So there's a couple little things she likes to do. And yeah, I try to, you know, give her a break sometimes because it's tough being with a 2-year-old all day. she can be demanding, and, you know, they're 2-year-olds, they throw fits. So
sort of like poker players.
Yeah, I guess they're very similar in a lot of ways.
Okay, so people can, they can watch you on Twitch. It's twitch.tv/gags30.
Correct, yes.
You are representing Borgata Poker.
This is correct.
If people want to contact you about coaching, how do they do that?
I have a website. It's gags30poker.com. And there's all information there, basically just like an email form. And then there's information about an FAQ about my coaching.
And Card Runner is also to watch your videos.
Just cardrunners.com.
Cardrunners.com. Anything else you want to suggest to people?
No, not really. I suggest that people that are in states where you'd like to see poker regulated and made, you know, I hate saying made legal because it's generally not illegal in most places, but you want to see poker regulated and back in the United States, you know, be sure to support the PPA and message your, you know, local representatives, your congressman and whoever else, because that's really the way that, you know, this stuff gets done is by people saying that they want something done. And I'm fortunate enough to be in a state where we do have regulated poker, and it's pretty great being able to play every night whenever I want. So definitely get out there and do that.
Last question I forgot to ask you that, sure. That we like to – sorry, Nate. Were you going to say something?
I was just going to thank him for coming on the show, but you have another thing to ask him.
Well, it occurred to me, we often ask our guests, if we get the hint that they might be readers, we like to ask for book recommendations. Do you have any?
I am certainly not a reader. I read a lot of stuff online. Like I'm a big Redditor. I read all the, you know, the links on Reddit and countless Reddit threads and stuff like that. But I'm very not much a reader. I'm into, you know, I like listening to podcasts. I like watching TV shows and movies and reading the internet, but no books for me, unfortunately.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. It really was a pleasure getting to know you. Thanks again to Carl for the recommendation. I think this worked out pretty nicely.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys. It's a pleasure being here.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get a chance to meet in person sometime, maybe WSOP. I used to get to Atlantic City sometimes, but I live on the West Coast now, so that doesn't happen too much.
Well, I will be there this summer, so I'd be happy to meet up.
All right, take care.
Take care.
Thanks so much, guys.
Yep, bye. Devotion of a car, the light of the fair passage of a bill.